can I sponsor the show? I'm going to buy ad time in which I just then can rebut everyone's argument.
Nate was wrong, right? Boom, boom,
and
boom.
Make my points.
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avriga, and there's lots to discuss on this rainy Monday. I don't know, listeners, where you are, if it's raining there, but I want you to know that we are all soaking wet and have been receiving these scary alerts about flash floods on our phones like every 30 seconds.
I had to change my shoes. My shoes were so wet. I'm wearing old New Balances.
So, listeners, feel bad for us because we are wet and scared.
I experienced snow in Kansas City this past weekend.
Ooh, yeah. Good for you. Here's what's up on today's show. We'll start with a look at how Americans feel about foreign intervention. This, of course, in the wake of the U.S. airstrikes on Syria that President Trump ordered on Friday night and were executed on Saturday morning. We will check in on former FBI Director James Comey. His new book comes out. Have you heard about that? It's Comey Week. It bumped Infrastructure Week yet again.
What if we could combine the two?
I'm pretty sure we could. And I guess the main thing we'll do is ask whether we are actually learning anything new during this Comey week. Here to mark the occasion, Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Jody.
Okay, we're getting better.
No, bit by that bit, was not
week
better.
By week. No, but there was a level of effort that I appreciated. Politics reporter Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
Should we just do the Cavs lost, Sixers won thing right now and get it out of the way?
Guess you could if you're a dick.
Yeah, well,
the Sixers not only won, they won in style.
And they've won 17 in a row, and we're going to the finals, and I could not be more confident of how – I should not be saying this out loud because I will have jinxed it.
Yeah, you did jinx it.
That is Micah Cohen,
knocking
Philadelphia area native as well.
Somewhat recovering Philadelphia sports fan.
Good for you. You're really getting out at the right time.
Yeah.
They won the Super Bowl. Villanova wins the championship. The Sixers are rolling. Even the Phillies are winning all these close games.
Bad timing. Quite amazing.
Yes. Also on the show, in addition to Syria and Comey, we're going to talk a little bit about the resignation of Paul Ryan. We had this great emergency podcast last week focused kind of on Ryan himself. Today, we'll turn the page and look at whether his departure changes what we already know about the midterms. But on these Syria airstrikes, the United States, in coordination with France and Britain, carried out a series of pre-dawn strikes on Saturday in Syria in response to what it said was a chemical weapons attack in the rebel-held Damascus suburb of Douma. The strikes were intense but limited so far. There's no talk or indication of continued engagement, which is, of course, something we're looking at. But Claire, you wrote this piece last year, kind of right around this time last year, the first time Trump ordered Syrian airstrikes, entitled, and I'm reading the headline of the piece here, America's Fickle Relationship with Humanitarian Intervention. So we can talk about whether this moment feels any different. We know it's at least a bigger strike. But what's the context, as you laid out in your piece, that we need to have in mind?
I think perhaps most pertinent for what we're talking about today, which is strikes on Syria, I went back and compared a number of humanitarian interventions and how U.S. citizens felt about it. But I think the one to bring up is in 2013, Obama wanted congressional approval for military action against Assad's government after it had used chemical weapons on civilians, and only 36% of Americans favored taking that action. Now, what's the difference between 2013 and 2016? In 2016, Americans approved of these strikes by a slim margin, and I think the big difference probably in what I can see is between 2013 and 2016, we saw the rise of ISIS, which is something that Americans were having a very visceral reaction to. But throughout our history, we've sort of bumped back and forth between how we feel about humanitarian interventions, often based off of how wars that have just happened have turned out for us. So after Iraq, we saw the genocide in Darfur, and Americans, while, you know, probably sympathetic to it, did not want to intervene in Darfur. So we've seen ourselves sort of ping pong back and forth about reacting it, about how we should go about intervening in foreign countries.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. A lot of these type of questions you don't see that much movement on, but this is one where, I mean, we called the American people fickle. Maybe they're not so much fickle as just like basing it on what's happened recently. I guess that is fickle. But
yeah, but you know, you saw, I think the 90s are an interesting example because in the early 90s, people wanted to intervene in Somalia.
Right.
And then you had, you know, Black Hawk Down. American soldiers were killed in Somalia on the ground. And so then when Bosnia and Kosovo were fighting, the Americans first didn't want to go in. And then they found out about the massacre of Srebrenica. And
right.
Public opinion changed around that time. So,
I mean, you've also had two consecutive presidents who kind of elected on, you know, Obama won the 2008 Democratic primary in part because he was opposed to the Iraq war from the start. You know, did America end its military interventionism under Obama? Well, no, not really, but that created some ambiguity, I think, in public opinion. And kind of arguably likewise, Trump, although like on many issues was a little bit all over the place, was enough differentiated from kind of GOP orthodoxy on foreign policy, again, claim that he had been opposed from the Iraq war from the get-go. That's not actually very clear from what he actually said at the time, but kind of campaigned against Bush's more interventionist and expansionist foreign policy, kind of almost a quasi-isolationist, I think kind of inspired some even left-wing pundits like Maureen Dowd to say, hey, he's actually a dove and Hillary is the hawk. And so, you know, so both parties now, it's actually one of the, oddly enough, the more nonpartisan issues now is kind of overall perceptions about kind of aggression in
the
our
right
foreign
thing
policy.
To do. Yeah. No, Julia Azari, 538 contributor, wrote a great piece for us that this path from, you know, campaigning on peace, governing in war is a well-worn path in American history. The other distinction we should probably make, though, is America's hesitancy towards fuller intervention kicks in when there's kind of more entanglement at risk. I think, at least nowadays, Americans almost always will support, you know, just like the bombing the shit out of someone for a day, which
in response to a gas attack or something. But I guess the question is Trump successfully, if that's the right word, framing it as a humanitarian intervention? Because, you know, one of the tweets leading up to this was about Putin and saying the missiles are coming if you continue to support this Assad guy. You know, how is this being framed and is it sort of being thought of in that narrow way?
So Trump framed it pretty explicitly when he announced the strikes as an attempt to deter chemical weapons use by the Assad regime and to draw a line in the sand more generally that chemical weapons use is not okay. I don't know whether that will mean there's more support for it or less. My hunch is that will mean there's – I think polls will come out showing people generally support these strikes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll watch those, and we will discuss if this story continues. But let's move on to our other topics today. We're going to talk about Comey Week in a minute. But first, let me tell you that this week's podcast is brought to you by Blue Bottle Coffee. Nothing gets your morning going quite like the first cup of coffee, but not just any coffee. You need delicious, flavorful coffee that'll change the way you look at coffee.
You said not just any coffee, just as I was about to drink my coffee, and now I don't want to drink it.
Terrible non-Blue Bottle coffee. Well, look, folks, don't be like Micah. You can get your Blue Bottle Coffee roasted and shipped directly to your home within 48 hours of placing your order, so the beans arrive at peak freshness. One sip of Blue Bottle Coffee will make you realize that you've been drinking subpar coffee your entire life. Blue Bottle Coffee has an insane dedication to coffee. They search the planet far and wide to secure exclusive relationships with independent growers all over the world to source only the most delicious and sustainable coffee there is. If you don't know exactly what kind of coffee you like, you can take their Blue Bottle Coffee Match quiz to find the perfect coffee for you. Go to bluebottlecoffee.com/politics for $10 off your first coffee subscription order. That's bluebottlecoffee.com/politics. Do it now. So let's talk a little bit about former FBI Director Jim Comey, who has a new book out this week. I will say that we have not gotten our hands on a full copy of the book. We've not read it in full, but there are excerpts floating around. He did a long interview on ABC last night. And then there is, of course, the spin and the political fallout, which may actually be more interesting or as interesting as anything. So we're going to touch on a few things from the book and maybe ask if there's anything really new here, both in terms of the revelations in the book, but also how this book will be perceived, if it will change the larger political conversation around Trump in general.
Nate's going to sit this segment out.
Yeah, Nate has nothing to say about this. So let's start on one specific thing, and then we'll expand, which is a quote from the book that has been making the rounds, and it is certainly in our wheelhouse. And maybe we can call this even a mini good use of polling or bad use of polling on the part of James Comey. So in discussing the letter he sent 11 days before the election, outlining that the FBI was investigating a new batch of Clinton emails. I'm sure listeners remember that moment. This is what Comey writes about that decision. Quote, "It is entirely possible that because I was making decisions in an environment where Hillary Clinton was sure to be the next president, my concern about making her an illegitimate president by concealing the restarted investigation bore greater weight than it would have if the election appeared closer or if Donald Trump were ahead in the polls. But I don't know," end quote. So I know, Nate, I know you want to jump in here, but very quickly, Micah, before we talk about this use of polling, remind us where we were on October 28th. What did the polls look like? What was that environment that Comey refers to?
So I'm looking at our election update on October 27th, 2016.
This is the day that Comey is writing up his letter.
Exactly. He's writing up his letter. He's deciding whether to send it or not. Trump had, in our polls only forecast, a 17% chance of winning, and in our polls plus forecast, a 19% chance of winning. That translates into what, Nate, like Clinton had about a 6% lead in the polls?
Clinton was up about 6 points nationally. Yeah.
Overall. Okay, so Nate, now that we have a sense of what that environment was on October 27th, what do you make of Comey's decision and the way he characterizes the decision?
First of all, in the book, or the passage from the book, he's a little bit more cutesy and ambiguous, right? He's like, you know, it wasn't consciously affecting my mind, but I've thought many times about whether unconsciously it was affecting me. In the ABC News interview, which I think is the more interesting document, it's a five-hour interview, really kind of focuses on this decision about, like, what was Comey thinking? From the ABC News interview, it seems a little bit clearer that this influenced his thinking, mm-hmm. or at least was more top of mind than back of mind. And throughout the ABC interview, this is a guy who is very, I mean, he like thinks like a political pundit. He's very concerned with how things will be perceived. He's concerned with the FBI's reputation, maybe first and foremost. He's concerned about, like, again, this is a guy who, by his own admission, has a lot of ego. And he's kind of very concerned, how am I going to look? And he's like, oh, woe is me, you know, I'm going to look really bad, but, like, let's see what will help the Bureau look good in the long term. There's a lot of that back and forth. And so, you know, so there are a couple of issues. Number one is the reason you have rules, and the rule, or at least the guideline, is that you don't intervene within whatever it is, you know, 30 days or 60 days of an election. The reason you have rules and guidelines is because when you're making decisions on an ad hoc basis, you tend to screw up. Okay, another issue. He's looking at the polls. Number one, he incorrectly says the polls said that Clinton was sure to win. You know, our model had a 1 in 5 or a 1 in 6 chance roughly of Trump winning. Others were lower than that. But a 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 chance, if you're someone who is the head of the FBI, you probably ought to know that like a 15% chance or 20% chance is a real probability that you ought to account for.
Can we conclude from this that James Comey is not a 538 reader?
I think he probably is a 530. I mean, George
referred to it. In my anecdotal experience, all lawyers are 530 readers.
Plenty of people like, read that update that you have up in front of you and thought, wrongly, Clinton is sure to win. I mean, plenty of smart people.
Well, but we
no,
also...
I don't think that's right. Really? I think plenty of people looked at our forecast and concluded wrongly. People were reading the update. The update's sure. clear. It's like, look, the polls are tightening. It says that.
You know, but third, and here's why he's a really made an idiotic decision, if that's his thinking, right? Most people, when you see the 538 forecast, you don't have any influence on the election itself, right? You know, the 15 or 20% chance that Trump has is contingent on me not being able to intervene and interfere with the news cycle in a way that, by Comey's own admission, would cause a lot of political damage to Hillary Clinton. So if you had asked us, what's the forecast if I write a letter to Congress 10 days before the election saying that the FBI investigation is being reopened? Well, that's a whole different freaking ballgame, right? And so the fact that, like, you know, he isn't aware that, like, he is actually an actor, a player in this forecast, not just a bystander or an observer. So I don't know. I mean, to me, it means that, again, he thinks like a pundit. He's someone who does not realize that, like, his decisions actually influence the reality of what he's looking at.
Or
he is not thinking about probability in any kind of rigorous way whatsoever.
I don't know if it's fair to characterize his thinking like a pundit.
Read the whole ABC transcript, though.
What I will say is that I think in the, you know, however many months since Comey made that actual decision, there's been a lot of talk about, like, James Comey's personal honor and whether or not it was, like, an honorable decision. I don't doubt his intentions in some ways, that he thought he was, like, doing his sort of, like, the prim and proper due diligence that he needed to do. But I think what many former FBI directors and people who have been in, you know, high government positions have said is just that it was a really weird decision. It was really out of the ordinary. And so to say, like, oh, I'm saying he's honorable or not honorable, like, who cares? It's just like the decision itself was very odd. And the fact that he was making the decision, his whole thing is like, I'm making these decisions based on the letter of the law, blah, blah, blah. But he's directly contradicting and saying, I was making this in a heated political environment. Like,
yeah.
I agree.
That's what it is.
And we need to stop.
That's where it gets into trouble.
His thinking is very convoluted.
Yes. No, and contradictory.
And I think he's made this big thing about, like, you know, I'm an imperfect person. Like, kind of own up to the fact that you were making what it comes down to, like, a political decision in some way because of your decision making was in some way actually.
Because he says there's another matter involving, the context a little bit confusing, around Loretta Lynch, and apparently there were like some false accusations around Loretta Lynch, but because of these false accusations that he knew were false, this is not the tarmac thing, which was stupid on everyone's part, right?
Yeah.
He's like, because of these false accusations against Loretta Lynch that might get leaked and that partisans might take advantage of, and that made it especially important that I spoke about the investigation and not Loretta Lynch, right? So, even though we knew these allegations were like BS, being rumors spread, you know, to cause chaos and disruption, the perception that the agency could be undermined this was more important. He kind of literally says this was more important than the actual truth of the matter. Okay, so to me, it's like if he had sold himself, and by the way, I don't think any of these decisions are easy. It's a pretty big problem if 10 days before the election you learn, hey, this sounds a little bit weird, but on Anthony Weiner's laptop we found all these emails that pertain to Hillary Clinton. You know, that's not like a slam dunk easy call. I'm not saying that. But if anything, he is not like this deeply rigorous and principled thinker. If anything, he's like a little bit of a pragmatist.
I just want to read something that Comey said in the interview that kind of just to put this in his words so we understand, and then Mike, you can jump in. But the way he characterized his notion of the department is, he says, when you're in the business of running a Justice Department, what people think matters. Public faith and confidence is everything to the Justice Department. So in a sense, there's a consistency there in him saying, I am always thinking about how this will be perceived.
Look, I agree with Comey that what the American people think of our law enforcement system is really important. I just wish he would say in that press conference, I mean, he basically cops in the book and in the ABC interview, he basically cops to bowing to political pressure. He basically says, I knew there would be a lot of conservative criticism if, one, I just released a one sentence, we're not pursuing charges against Hillary Clinton, and two, if he didn't notify Congress that they found these emails on the laptop, right? He says, I knew there would be a lot of suspicion and criticism of the FBI. That was his concern. And why is he concerned about that? Because conservatives and people on the right for a long time have leveled accusations of bias against the media. And Trump was, right? The problem is then, he won't just say, that's why I did it, or it was a mistake to do it. And so he's twisting himself. He recounts this story of Cheney, of they were debating the government, you know, government surveillance, which Comey was calling unlawful. Cheney wanted him to sign it as acting attorney general. And he recounts the story of Cheney saying, thousands of people are going to die because of what you're doing. And Comey says, his response is, I care about that, sir, but I have to make the decision on just what the law says, right? Then he recounts the debate over sanctioning torture, and he tells the story of his wife telling him, don't be the torture guy. Well, that's not in the law, right? But he's clearly it had an effect on his thinking. The same is true of these decisions during the campaign.
Nate, you kind of said that Comey didn't realize in his decision around the Clinton letter that he was an actor in this. When he was looking at the polling, he didn't realize that he could affect the polling. But, you know, if you read that quote where he says, I did this decision because I realized that it would potentially make Hillary Clinton's presidency illegitimate, isn't that him admitting that he knows he's a big actor, that his decision-making has a big force?
Again, it's not a very clear explanation, and there are parts that are contradictory. There are also parts of these interviews in the book where he kind of says, I wasn't affected at all by the polling. You know, there's inconsistent rationales about why he doesn't go forward with saying more about Russia, for example, you know, where at some point he says this was guidelines. At other points he says, I was willing to go forward, but the Obama White House did not want me to go forward.
Oh, I was somewhat convinced by that explanation, which was that the Clinton investigation was started by a public inquiry, while the Russia investigation
was in its nascent stages and was not yet public.
Exactly. Just to take a step back for a second, though, I don't actually like this whole debate about Comey's motivations and whether he did the right thing or not. I think misses the forest for the trees a little bit, and I think misses a much more interesting debate about the like why he's doing this book now.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of.
So we can talk forest in a sec.
Why do you think he's doing the book? I mean, because one of the things that you're supposed to do as a book reviewer, you're supposed to say, what was the goal of this book? And let me evaluate it on those terms. Like, what do you think his goal was and how would you evaluate
it? So he says his goal was to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't the most useful thing...
Useful how?
So I think he says his goal was to be useful in... He wanted to show people there was a different kind of moral leadership. This is what leadership should look like. I think he also wants to be useful, frankly, in the... argument against Trump,
right.
in the case against Trump. I think he would be most useful in the case against Trump by trying to maintain a sheen of nonpartisan veneer, and that's well gone now. So I don't know.
It is funny where no one can resist nowadays being part of like the media cycle. It really is this sort of intoxicating thing. And like you almost saw it when Comey signed up for like Twitter and Instagram, or like came out of his Twitter Reinhold Niebuhr account, which is a whole other thing.
Sorry, on that point, we talked about that Michael Wolff book when it came out and about what it taught us about the Trump presidency. And this is the next sort of other big book that maybe starts to get at some of those same themes. But because Comey is a principal here, does that make him less of a reliable narrator? I mean, is it harder to get this message given the messenger?
I'm not sure I would conflate those two books because I think journalistically, I'm not sure. I think Michael Wolff is a totally reliable narrator. I think James Comey obviously is now a player in this. He feels his reputation is at stake. He knows that he is a player in history, whether or not he'll say it explicitly or not. And that's what this whole thing is about. He seems to me a person a bit obsessed with his honor in... You know, maybe, as the president has said, a sanctimonious way. You know, can you fault a guy for going out there and doing a media blitz when the president of the United States has, you know, sort of taking a lot of ad hominem personal attacks against him? Maybe
That's
not.
Right. Yeah.
To go back to the point of if James Comey's whole shtick about leadership is you do what's right, even when the forces around you of politics and everything are swirling. It doesn't exactly, you
match
know, the words might be something, but the actions are.
Although, who am I, you know, who are we to tell him? That's a lot of money. And just to be clear, I would take the money and write the book. So,
but it's the sanctimony that surrounds all of it.
Well, he's the least reliable narrator, I think, when talking about his own thinking and own motivation.
Like, I think this
I
is...
I trust him on what happened
I think
to
he's
Trump.
A, I think, to be clear, I think he's a reliable narrator in the sense of interactions with Trump.
Yeah.
I think where it gets to be, like, Jim Comey's spin is in interviews
but
like that.
But he
like,
needed to address that in order to...
What address what?
Address kind of what were you thinking, your decision-making, so forth. He couldn't have just come out and written a sort of TikTok of what he saw around
well, he
Trump,
gave,
right?
Well, he didn't have to write
to his credit, he gave this five-hour interview of which ABC spends like two whole hours. I mean, this is like 44,000 words, a transcript. I was reading on the very delayed plane ride last night. You know, Stephanopoulos spends like a whole hour and a half like kind of honing in on the decision. And like, I guess that level of transparency is like admirable in a way. At the same time, I don't know. Look, one thing that happens is that your star blows up. You're a person that people want to hear from. And a big risk is that you have the opportunity to opine on things that are not really in your expertise, right?
Are you speaking from personal experience on this?
Micah? But, you know, I don't really care whether Comey thinks that Trump is morally fit to be the president, except as it pertains to knowledge that Comey has directly of Trump.
Yeah, I agree.
He's not a very particularly good political pundit, right? He's almost like a Chris Saliza stereotype where he's like, I always wore a yellow tie because blue ties and red ties could signify partisanship.
No, when
right?
he takes cheap blue shots and red are, at Trump.
Yeah, he takes a lot of cheap the hand remarks. And yeah. like,
I think his editor did him a disservice there by mm-hmm. either asking him to put those things in or by not taking them out.
Tanning goggle remark.
He does, when you read the super long transcript, he does come off kind of just as a classic never Trumper, like a Rick Wilson type
right.
or whatever,
and I
who's
have
just
to,
sort of staking out this.
I have to say the vernacular of the never Trumper or the vernacular of like the principled liberal taking a stand up against Trump, it's all so tiresome. You say the same words over and over, you make the same attacks on the president over and over again. And to a certain extent, you have to, right? If you're a person holding those positions, you have to say he's immoral, he's not fit for office. But some of the like the language that Comey used and some of the sort of incredibly predictable attacks on Trump he used, I thought distracted from the meat of what he had, which were disturbing conversations with the president of the United States. The fact that he says to Stephanopoulos, I can't say for certain whether or not the Russians have something on the president of the United States. That in and of itself stands, and that I would say if I were media training Jim Comey or editing his book, I would say remove yourself from the sort of muddy business that other people do and keep yourself in, you know, in this higher reserve, because that, I mean, lean into the sanctimony. Don't.
No, I totally agree. But it's also like this conversation also speaks to a frustration I have. Claire's right that the meat of this sort of is very credible and is very problematic. And so we're all saying, and I said, you know, his more personal attacks on Trump undermine yeah. that case. They really shouldn't, right? One has nothing to do with the other. It's all about theater and
framing.
And framing. And that's why I'm getting a little frustrated. I think we're falling into what I think most of the media has done, which is this like big conversation about James Comey the person rather than the conversation we should be having, which is like, what happened here?
James Comey is a purveyor of evidence, and that is James Comey's only
but
use
not
in
anymore.
But truly, like, James Comey's only use in history will be the fact that he took detailed notes and that he has led a career that makes people think that he is an upstanding person and that his recollections against the president of the United States are worthwhile.
Are credible.
Other than
yeah.
that, who gives
and
well, yeah,
a rat's patoots
about it? I noticed that too, Claire. It's like totally reversed, right? To me, there are three big buckets of Comey stuff, right? One is his interactions with Trump and why he was fired by Trump. Mm-hmm. That's the most important for right now. Two is like his decision around 2016 and the Clinton investigation. And by the way, the Russia investigation in 2016. That's also pretty important. It's a little bit of rearview mirroring at this point, but pretty important. And the third is everything else. If you look at the news coverage, it's exactly the opposite order, right? It's all the everything else is the headline. The 2016 stuff is getting ample coverage. And the stuff about like how did Trump became when he became president in those couple of months where you overlapped and where there may have been obstruction of justice is not getting very much coverage. And there's not very much news there in Comey's book.
Can you elaborate on that, though, that notion that there isn't much news here? I mean, that's where I kind of want to
end.
Yeah, because he did testimony. He's presumably talked to the Mueller team. So is there, on what you would label as the number one priority, his interactions with Trump and his firing, is there anything apparent seemingly?
Because he leaked all that stuff
testified, maybe not both.
But wasn't the stuff about Trump repeatedly calling him to worry/complain about the prostitute allegations in particular?
Claire, you want to give that context?
It's that the president called Jim Comey a lot. Seemed to have a fixation on the Steele dossier parts about prostitutes. Right, Micah? Is that like...
Yeah, that's right. And he called Comey on a number of occasions and sort of said, I think one time in person said, do I seem like the type of person who needs prostitutes? Then on another occasion said this, it wasn't true because he was a germaphobe.
Does that count? Does that feel substantive?
I don't give a shit about that stuff, to be honest. I really don't. Like, I don't care if there's a tape of...
I mean,
I think
to the point of, like, you know, if we're talking about why people care so much about James Comey, it is because of the Clinton email involvement and then the firing and what his account of that is. But Comey is also this... He seems like this figure in American life who's fallen victim to hubris, and he talks a lot about... You know, essentially the line, he doesn't say it like this, but, you know, there's a line of like, don't believe your own bullshit.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like Comey is a very self-aware person and is aware that he shouldn't believe his own bullshit, but he believes his own bullshit. His bullshit being the sanctimony he has about you know, he was above the political forces that were swirling in Washington. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're a person in the federal government and you hold a high position, yes, the FBI is an independent institution, but like all of these people are figures in politics. Yeah. They are swayed by political things.
There's a fun compare and contrast between Comey's book and Hillary Clinton's book. You know, I think Hillary Clinton's book expressed clearer thinking about her decision making and what the mistakes were and what parts of it she defends, right?
But she has an easier way to make a clear case. She has a clearer side in things. Comey's Comey's central thing is he's a tortured figure in
but
American
there, there
politics.
But there were a lot of
know what he thinks.
For sure. There were a lot of people though who are happy to portray Comey as this tragic figure, and no one's telling Comey to go away as they were with Clinton.
I mean, I generally agree. I think there's a little bit of that. I think part of this week is everyone's remembering, no matter where you are on
but
the
also
political spectrum,
look,
that
he,
you don't,
he
that
has
Comey
not,
annoys you.
He has not represented himself very well. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book. You know, in the interview, you know, he does not come across very well. You talk about the P-tape, and I don't care about the P-tape either. He seems titillated by speculating about, like, whether or not there's a P-tape, you know? I don't begrudge him that personally, I guess. Maybe he's more interested in gossip than I am, right? But it's not very... doesn't convey the kind of austerity and gravitas that you would want.
I don't think we have any
anymore. Aren't you falling into the trap of judging all this on theatricality and does he fit the part? Like, who gives it? I agree with all that.
On substance, he violated what any other FBI director would have done and has a lot of trouble and has a very confused rationale for his decision making, right? It's not convincing.
Any final thoughts about whether there's something new here? Or?
My one final thought is, like, let's not judge Comey as a person. I think he's seems like a person trying to do the right thing who f***ed up in a couple really important situations. The redeeming thing about Comey is that he seems somewhat ashamed to have written this memoir.
He clearly does have a lot of guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in my book, but let's be clear. He's okay.
James Comey had the third most influence in the outcome of the election of any three people, right? So in some order, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are 1A and 1B, and the number three is James Comey. So he has a lot on his shoulders to wrestle with, and I'm empathetic in the sense that, like, it's a lot to weigh. They were hard decisions made under conditions. I mean, at one point he referred to, in the interview with ABC, the 500-year flood, right? And he's like, this is a one in every 500 years, these horrible circumstances come together that made my life really hard. And I'm kind of sympathetic to that.
I think James Comey is a classic example of the old Washington phrase, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. And I would say to members of the resistance or people who are, you know, Trump supporters who were cheering Comey for whatever reason, like, you know, if you want a friend in a politician or a political figure, get a dog, because... you know, it really cuts to the heart of people's political beliefs. Like, these people are people. They're fragile figures, and they make big mistakes, as Comey did. And, you know, no one's going to be a perfect actor in a situation. He is an incredibly imperfect person, as is everyone involved in politics ever.
Except for us.
Congratulations. We just completed the perfect podcast segment, and we're going to move on from that. And listeners, I'll just say that it is really worth reading that full transcript. ABC had to cut their thing down to an hour, but there are thousands and thousands of words between Stephanopoulos and Comey where Comey really lays out all of this thinking, whether you buy it or not. It's there, and you should totally read it, in addition to reading the book. Up next, we're going to talk a little bit about the Paul Ryan retirement news and what it means for the midterms and beyond. But first, let me tell you that this week's podcast is brought to you by Sunbasket. Sunbasket has been rated the number one meal kit by leading publications, and it is no wonder why. They offer 18 weekly recipes with options for paleo, gluten-free, Mediterranean, lean and clean, vegan, and more. No matter what diet you want to take on, Sunbasket will help you eat healthier. It's as simple as that. Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much experience you have in the kitchen. You can get more options than ever right now. Just go to the Sunbasket app and pick from 18 weekly recipes, easily cooked dishes like seared albacore tuna steaks and green beans and soft cooked eggs. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep. You get a healthy and delicious meal on the table, your table, from your kitchen in about 30 minutes. There's something for every healthy journey and every busy lifestyle. Go to sunbasket.com sunbasket.com/politics today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/politics for $35 off. Once again, sunbasket.com/politics. This week's podcast is also brought to you by Dollar Shave Club. Your bathroom is calling. Do you hear that? It's time to give it the cleaning it deserves. It's time to get rid of all that junk that's lying around. You can freshen it up with high-quality products from Dollar Shave Club. Members get everything they need for their morning routine delivered right to their door. Dollar Shave Club is more than just razors. There's shave butter, shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, and everything you need to look, smell, and feel your best. You get an amazing high-quality shave every morning from Dollar Shave Club, of course, with their executive razor. It is the best razor out there. There's the Dr. Carver's Shave Butter. It goes on clear and you can see where you are shaving. And since Dollar Shave Club delivers everything to you, you don't have to set foot in a store wondering where the aisle is for razors and you have to deal with those little plastic things that don't let you actually get at the razor. You can just get it delivered to you along with shampoo, body wash, toothpaste, all of it delivered right to your home. Clean up your bathroom and your morning routine. Join Dollar Shave Club today for just $5 with free shipping and you'll get the 6-blade executive razor plus trial sizes of shave butter, body cleanser, and one wipe Charlie's. Then you can keep the blades coming for just a few bucks a month. Get it right now, dollarshaveclub.com/politics. That's dollarshaveclub.com/politics. All right, we are back, and let's talk a little bit about House Speaker Paul Ryan, who, of course, announced last week that he is retiring at the end of his term. We did an emergency podcast last Wednesday reacting to the news. Shout out to Galen and Perry and Julia for doing that. And that conversation was a little more looking back at Ryan's career and his place in politics. So right now, let's look forward and ask what his retirement fundamentally changes, if anything, for what we know about the midterms this fall. So, Nate, there were a lot of articles in the wake of Ryan's retirement describing Republicans in panic mode and Democrats feeling more optimistic than ever. Was Ryan's retirement actually something that feels like it changed that calculus?
Well, I barely even remember it happened given how much news there's been over the past week. I mean, look, there are various consequences to this, one of which is that wave elections are a little bit self-inflicted sometimes because of retirements and people kind of preemptively retire. And so there can be like kind of a cascading effect. We are past the point in the cycle now where ordinarily you have very many retirements. But I think it was some NRCC or whatever spokesman who said, you know, we expect 10 or fewer retirements at this stage, right? Or fewer than 10. Ordinarily you would have like one or two maybe. And so if there are a few more retirements, also Ryan's district itself is going to be
competitive.
May have been competitive already. You can debate that. But like that's another swing district now.
There was some reporting to Nate's point that Ryan waited to make this announcement until he knew that most of the retirements that were going to happen had already happened.
Interesting. Do you
buy
that? But
most versus all is
different.
Right.
But do you buy that?
If you were Ryan's people, it would make sense to talk to your caucus, talk around, be like, okay, is this most of the people who are going to retire? Because they're worried about him retiring, then getting 3, 4, 5 retirements in
afterwards,
a row.
And the narrative being
exactly
Ryan caused those people to retire.
Oh, interesting.
When in fact they might have been planning on it anyway.
They probably were anyway. But right. So this is maybe one sign that we've gotten most, not all, but most of the GOP retirements we're going to get.
I mean, yes. But for me, you know, obviously it could set off a struggle for leadership. It seems like Kevin McCarthy is like in the position to
The leader.
Become the next leader. Whether he'll be the speaker or not will depend on whether Republicans retain the House. I tend to put the Ryan news more in the frame of not the inevitable consequence, but like a consequence instead of a cause, right? A consequence of the fact that, like, look, I think people might overrate how certain it is Democrats are going to take the House. However, let's say Democrats come up a few seats short, you know, having to manage a like 3-member majority,
yeah,
or something where all the shit is hitting the fan with Trump, where any special election could potentially tip the balance, right? Where the Freedom Caucus has like infinite leverage, right? I mean, that's not a very fun job either.
At all. I think I was listening to, I think John Dickerson said this, where he made the good point that the speakership just isn't that powerful anymore.
Right.
And so in addition to, even if he kept the majority, he would still have, you know, these really powerful kind of pain in your ass factions with you know, the House Freedom Caucus, things like that. But then also he's just working with the president that, like, listen, okay, Ryan's statements have been largely like supportive to tepidly supportive of the president. But it's pretty obvious reading between the lines that he's not a fan of this guy. He doesn't really want to be around when, you know, the Mueller investigation really picks up steam in the next year or so. Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty logical decision on the part of Ryan.
But like, there's a lot of non-midterm reasons for him to want to get out as well, is kind of what you're saying.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just going to be, it's a thankless job, and it's not going to get any better.
So,
like, literally, it's not going to get any better. He did the thing that he wanted to do in passing tax reform. I don't think he has a lot of steam left, and this guy's been, like, you know, the whole thing of, like, spending time with your kids, like, I do buy that he wants to do that, but I also think that he's, like, he's been on the Hill for a very long time for a person as young as he is, and I think he probably sees is reading the tea leaves and doesn't think it's going to get any easier. So if you're Paul Ryan and you're saying, like, listen, I'm not that old of a guy, I can have maybe 5 years to recoup and sort of press the reset button a little bit on my political career, why wouldn't you do it, in addition to it maybe being the right thing for your family at the time?
Just to linger on that, though, that feels like maybe even a bigger sort of more intense thing than just, wow, Paul Ryan, sitting speaker, has announced he's not going to run again. That, like, are we living in an era where no one should ever want to be speaker, where this is a sort of hopeless task, where is Paul Ryan's, is it like, well, saying something about politics writ large?
To me, the question is it that no one wants to be speaker or no one wants to be Republican speaker?
Yeah.
Right. And I'm not sure what the answer is, to be honest with you. I think there are certainly dynamics in the GOP caucus that make being speaker with Republicans in the majority hard. But this is a total side note, but this is another example of why I think Pelosi gets a raw deal and the press is like...
Yeah, but I also think that, you know, should the Democrats win the House and should Pelosi be speaker come the fall, it's also a very different Democratic Party. Like, I think
they're running the same issues.
Yeah. And frankly, I think she would. I mean, you have a pretty vocal minority on the Democratic side that wants her gone, and that I think, you know, let's say the Democrats win the House, that leadership election could be close, and you could have people who are saying, like, all right, we're making a play, and, like, this is going to be a whole new ballgame coming down the stretch to 2020, and we want to, like, really reframe the way people are thinking about the Democrats, and sexism, ageism, accusations aside, we need to press the reset button. There is something to be said for reset buttons in politics, and, like, I actually think the Democrats are going to face a similar sort of, like, I don't think to the extreme that Republicans do, because Republicans, they almost have, like, people in a separate party. When you get to the idea of House Freedom Caucus people versus, what is it, the Tuesday caucus or the moderate
Tuesday group?
The Tuesday group, the group of moderates. Those people are essentially in different parties. Yes.
Well, okay. So let me push back on that a little bit. Julia is writing a piece that's about the idea that Paul Ryan and, you know, there were a lot of takes after the Ryan retirement that, oh, this shows the complete Trumpification of the Republican Party, as though Ryan and Trump occupied, in effect, separate parties. And there's a lot of research to show that it is not so simple to separate fiscal conservatism from cultural conservatism, that one bleeds into the other, and people claim fiscal conservatism when actually it's cultural conservatism and vice versa.
Although I would say that in the Trump era, when you're delineating out, you know, Republicans of different, you know, fiscal conservatives versus cultural conservatives, in some way what it actually is coming down to is, like, anti-Trump Republicans and sort of quietly anti-Trump Republicans and people who are perfectly okay with the direction of the party. That to me is more the separation. It's like Susan Collins types and, you know, Murkowski, like, those are the people, and a few others, like, those are the people who are just, like, really, you know, the subtext never Trumper types. And there are others of those who are maybe more in the middle as far as, like, blending of fiscal and cultural conservatism, who are very anti-Trump and who would probably place themselves on a spectrum closer to, like, Murkowski and Collins.
I guess, no, I agree with that. I guess my point is just that Trump and Ryan are very different in terms of demeanor,
yes,
in terms of style.
You're saying, but beliefs-wise, they share a lot more.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you.
Let's end by going back a little bit to some of the maybe tea leaves for the midterm that are in this decision, or what are some of the sort of indications from it. So let's just run down a few things that we have our eye on for the midterms. One, Paul Ryan was a pretty good fundraiser. There was a lot of talk about losing him as a fundraising engine. Is that a serious concern, Micah? You're shaking your head.
No.
You're shaking your head this way. Sometimes people say shaking your head for going up and down. He's going right to left.
Left and right. Horizontally. No, that's not. I mean, sure, he was a great fundraiser. They have plenty of good fundraisers.
Okay. The retirements. There are 43 Republicans leaving the House. Most are retiring. Some are running for other office. Let's say that that's the universe of people who are retiring. Nate, what do you make of that number, 43? We've talked a lot about the incumbency advantage. Is that a real challenge for Republicans?
Yes.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the number 43 more generally, though?
I mean, 43 is a pretty good number. Uh-huh. You know, I wore 14 when I played baseball as a youth. I think 14 is an underrated number.
I wore two.
Two is a good
when
number.
When I play field hockey.
I wore eight.
I wore eight, too, as
eight.
Well.
Punks.
Eight. We got eight.
No, look, it's I think, by some standards, a record high number of retirements.
Mm-hmm.
And it has both direct and indirect effects, right? The direct effect is that, like, obviously it's easier to beat a non-incumbent, even though the incumbency advantage has diminished over the years. You'd still much rather be facing an open seat race. And secondly is that, like, one can argue that sometimes politicians actually are polling their districts, are kind of correctly assessing the mood of voters, and so therefore they have kind of information on on-the-ground conditions. And so, yeah, usually when you have this many retirements, it's a leading indicator for a wave. It's one of the more worrying signs for Republicans.
This is something we're going to get into more, both on the site and I think on the podcast, of like retirements and how to view them. I mean, there are a couple different ways to count, I think, you know, in terms of who retired for scandal, who's where. But it's something people have latched onto in a way they haven't before as like a midterm marker. And it's pretty interesting.
When we look at the other indicators, you know, the generic ballot, Micah, maybe you can tell us where the generic ballot stands right now. Trump approval, the indicators from special elections. How do you fit, Nate, turnover, retirement into that universe of tea leaves?
The generic ballot has tightened.
It's
six points now. So I think people are maybe a little bit cherry picky about ignoring this indicator, which they made a big deal of before. But yeah, like the best indicator for Democrats, or the two best ones, are probably special elections
and retirements.
Yeah. You could pick and choose which of those is better. I'd probably put special elections number one and retirements number two, and then presidential approval number three. And the generic ballot actually would be the one of those four indicators where if you looked at that, you might say, oh, the GOP will just barely hang on if you looked at that right now, although it's been a larger lead for Democrats in the past.
Okay, let's start to wrap up. One last question as we close the door on the Paul Ryan era. Will we ever see a sitting House Speaker do a photo shoot lifting weights and wearing a backwards red baseball cap? Quick predictions.
Nancy Pelosi, maybe.
Nancy Pelosi.
Maybe, ironically.
Oh, ironically.
That was a great, unironically, what a great photo shoot.
Yeah.
Like, props to that photographer for catching him in these perfect, like, unguarded moments.
Okay, let's wrap up. Nate Silver, friend and participant of the show. Thank you, as always.
Merely a participant.
Claire, wow.
Jeez.
Claire Malone, thank you.
Thanks, Jody.
And thanks to you, Micah Cohen.
Thanks.
My name is Jody Avergan. A quick plug, because it is plug time at the end of the show. As you know, I have this other part of my podcast life where we do these 30 for 30 podcasts. We have an event coming up on Sunday, the 22nd. That's just this upcoming Sunday as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. If you are listening to this and are in New York City, come check it out. You can Google it, Tribeca Film Festival, 30 for 30 podcasts. Should be a really interesting conversation. I'd love to see you. Since we're in plug mode, Claire, do you want to plug this new newsletter of yours that I'm very excited about?
I guess I have a newsletter now. It's nothing special. It'll just be stuff I've written. So sign up for it. There's a link on my Twitter.
There you go. Galen Druk is our producer, and Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us, podcasts@538.com. You can also tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts, or just tell someone about the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.